So now let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 31. And we will begin by reading verses 8 through 13. We left off with 8 last time, and I'll just reread that and then go down through 13. Deuteronomy 31, "The Lord is the one who goes ahead of you. He will be with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. Do not fear or be dismayed." So Moses wrote this law and gave it to the priests, the sons of Levi, who carried it on the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, and to all the elders of Israel. Then Moses commanded them, saying, "At the end of every 7 years, at the time of the year of remission of debts, at the Feast of Booths, when all Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God at the place which he will choose, you shall read this law in front of all Israel in their hearing. Assemble the people, the men and the women and the children and the alien who is in your town, so that they may hear and learn and fear the Lord your God, and be careful to observe all the words of this law. Their children who have not known will hear and learn to fear the Lord your God as long as you live on the land which you are about to cross the Jordan to possess." And so these are pretty straightforward words, but they are so consistent with what Moses has been saying. It's a theme that's repeated over and over and over again, that here is the law, you need to follow it. So he wrote all of this out, according to verse 9, and he gave it to the priests. And if you recall, it had already been discussed that this law that he wrote was to be carried with, alongside the covenant, the Ark of the Covenant. And so it didn't go in the Ark, but it went with the Ark, and it was to be used to remind the people of what they were called to do. And he told them, on the 7-year sabbatical, every time that happens, get the book out and read the law. So this is to be an ongoing tool that's going to be used at the every 7 years. It will be a time of Feast of Booths. It will be when the debts are let go and the clocks are reset with regard to those things. And then all of Israel is to come together for those Feasts of the Booths. And while they're there, at a place that God's going to choose, you read this law in front of all Israel at their hearing. And there's a purpose here. When you get all the people together, the women and the children and the alien, this isn't just for the Jewish people. This is for anyone that wants to be a part of living in this land that happens to be a part of that. You will read it, and they will hear and learn and fear the Lord your God. And they will be careful, and then be careful to observe all the words of the law. And one focus of all of this is the children who have not known. This is a part of reinforcing it in their education system, in their way of teaching the young people, this is who we are as a people, this is how we got here, this is what's going on. They get to bring the book out and read it, and they can hear it again and have it reinforced. I think there's something more than just the words here that's going on, though, because when they get the book out, I think Moses anticipates, I anticipate as I read it, it's not just going to be the latest copy that some scribe went out and made a copy of it. This is going to be, where did we get this book? This book was written by Moses' own hand. As God gave him this law, he put it down for us. And so before we ever entered this land, these words were written for us. And there's a purpose in it. And as they read it right here in these words, they're going to say the part of the purpose is that you'll have a long life and live in the land that's given to you as an inheritance, as a promise for the many years to come. And so Moses is establishing that through God's direction here, that all of these words are going to be written down. They are written down and will be used for that purpose. Thoughts, comments? You know, one of the things we don't have, and it's probably a good thing in one sense, we don't have the original letters of anything here in the Bible. And for sometimes we think that's a weakness. But we mankind have a tendency to worship objects, don't we? And it might be just as well that we don't say, here's the one that really got sent. It really, the first one from Paul. But we've got so much evidence from what the scribes did, what the people did as they were putting the canon of the Bible together, and what has been done over the years. We've got so many things that show us that what we have is absolutely accurate. And there's really no question about it. And we should be very thankful for that, just as these people should have been thankful for what Moses was being asked to give to them by Yahweh. Let's turn over now and read verses 14 through 22, a little bit longer passage. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, the time for you to die is near. Call Joshua and present yourselves at the tent of meeting that I may commission him." So Moses and Joshua went and presented themselves at the tent of meeting. The Lord appeared in the tent in a pillar of cloud, and the pillar of cloud stood at the doorway of the tent. The Lord said to Moses, "Behold, you're about to lie down with your fathers, and this people will arise and play the harlot with the strange gods of the land into the midst of which they are going, and will forsake me and break my covenant which I have made with them. Then my anger will be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them and hide my face from them, and they will be consumed, and many evils and troubles will come upon them, so that they will say in that day, 'Is it not because our God is not among us that these evils have come upon us?' But I will surely hide my face in that day because of all the evil which they will do, for they will turn to other gods. Now, therefore, write this song for yourselves and teach it to the sons of Israel. Put it on their lips so that this song may be a witness for me against the sons of Israel. For when I bring them into the land flowing with milk and honey, which I swore to their fathers, and they've eaten and are satisfied and become prosperous, then they will turn to other gods and serve them and spurn me and break my covenant. Then it shall come about when many evils and troubles have come upon them that this song will testify before them as a witness. For it shall not be forgotten from the lips of their descendants. For I know their intent which they are developing today before I have brought them into the land which I swore." So Moses wrote this song the same day and taught it to the sons of Israel. And we'll get to the song a little later. That's actually chapter 32. So the Lord says to Moses at the beginning of this passage we just read, "Hey, your time is coming. You're about to die. Call Joshua and present yourselves at the tabernacle, at the tent of the meeting. I'm going to commission him." So Moses and Joshua showed up at the tent of the meeting. Yahweh is there in a pillar of cloud, and he stood in the doorway with them. So here's this time of intimacy in a way that is just phenomenal, that few would enjoy with Yahweh, where you see him in the pillar of cloud. The people have been marching across the countryside, watching him, following him as a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. He's back again. He's in seen in this way, and he stands in the doorway, and he talks to Moses. Now, he said, "Come together, because I'm going to commission Joshua." But that isn't what he starts with. Yahweh says, "You're going to lie down with your fathers." Okay, we knew that was coming. But he talks about what the Jews are going to do. These Jews, these people will get up. They will play the harlot with strange gods. The ones in Canaan, as they go in, they will forsake me and the covenant I've made with them. Now, there's something amazing that's going to happen here before we're done that we'll see in a moment. But here is God knowing what's coming. Now, that we would expect that to be true if we go back and relate to the characteristics of God. He's all-knowing. He's not limited by what can be known by you and me in a particular time. He can see all this. He sees what's coming. He knows what they're going to do. He knows what's in their hearts. He says they're going to forsake me and the covenant I made with them. And he says, here's how I'm going to react in verse 17. My anger is going to rise up against them. And I'm going to forsake them. I will hide my face from them, and they will be consumed. They will experience many evils. Troubles are going to visit them. So that there's a purpose. And what was the purpose? What would happen to them in that time? It's there in verse 17. What is the purpose that God gives them these troubles for? Can you see it there? What will they say to themselves?
God is not among them.
Our troubles is because God is not here with us. And they don't mean one of these false gods that they have bought into in the land of Canaan and played the harlot with and done all the socializing with all the Canaanites with. They will say to themselves at that time, isn't this because Elohim, is the word that's used there, is not with us? So what is God's purpose? His purpose is to draw them back to him. He says, for certain, I will hide my face in that time because of the evil they will do when they turn to other gods. And he tells Moses then, for this reason, write this song for yourselves. Teach it to the Israelite descendants. Have them memorize it. It's going to be a witness for me against Israel's descendants. And the idea here is that as these people memorize what is written, they will have already in their knowledge what the cause of their calamities are. They will know that the one true living God forecast what was to happen and told them this would be the result. So it's a testimony for God himself. In verse 20, he says, I'm going to bring them to the land flowing with milk and honey that I promised to their fathers, and they're going to prosper. They're going to eat. They're going to be satisfied in their satisfactions when they turn to the other gods. They serve them, but they spurn me, and they will break my commandments. Do you see the danger of prosperity and success? What is the danger of prosperity and success? How would you put it in your words?
We can become reliant on ourselves and think that we did it versus giving the credit to God.
The last part of what you said is the first part of the problem. We think we did it. We think we did it. I worked hard. I went to school, I got educated, whatever it might be that's made for your success. Maybe you could think about it as a country, our military successes, our financial successes. And what do we look to thinking that's what brought us prosperity, even yet today? I mean, this is really a problem in this country. Big time, right now. Because we look around and we think, the answer to make everything better in the way we would like it to be better is the banking system, the taxation system, the people we put in office. We think militarily that if we build better weapons and more of them, then we're going to be just fine. Nobody will dare mess with us. Well, the Israelites had those kinds of attitudes as well. A lot of their biggest troubles, if we looked ahead, and I'm not going to try to look ahead with any great amount of detail, are going to come after Solomon's era. Well, they're going to have some other troubles along the way, but the real falling away, the real destruction of the land that's going to lead them to be separated and to be split in two, not even be unified amongst themselves, and that will eventually result in the kinds of things that God has been describing and what we're looking at, is going to come right behind, begin its fall at the end of Solomon's reign. And what was Solomon's reign? They had the wisest man that had ever been in charge of a country, but he let his faults show pretty badly. But they were also the richest they'd ever been. They built their military up. Nobody could threaten them. And yet the generation following Solomon, they weren't even a unified country. And what was one of the things that Solomon, in all of his wealth and power and fame, for his wisdom brought in foreign women. That by itself was a bit of a challenge, but when you bring in foreign women, what do you bring in with them?
Their idols
and their gods. And you have brought these women into your life as partners in that part of his life, and he's not going to tell them their gods are all false. He's going to socialize with them, worship with them, worship with their families. Some of those came out of alliances, alliances with other kings who worship foreign gods. That was part of diplomacy. And so when we begin to think that we are where we are as a nation or as individuals because of our own hard work alone, we're in trouble. We're weak. Pride goes before the fall. And Moses is trying to tell these people, because God told him, when you go into this land, pay attention and follow God's laws and love him, because you're going to make yourselves vulnerable. You're going to do things you will regret, and God is going to bring calamity upon you. Verse 21, when their troubles come, this song will testify before them as a witness. He didn't say if troubles come, but when troubles come. And the descendants then will remember the message that's starting today in this period of time with Moses warning them about what's important for them when they move into the promised land, so it can stay the promised land. They can stay in God's eye as his people and stay in good graces with him and prosper. And he says, I know the intent in verse 21 that they are making now, before I even bring them into the land I promised. These people had a problem. They were already thinking about their own position, their own power, and their own prosperity. And what was their biggest idol? It was themselves. And then in verse 22, Moses wrote the song that same day and taught it to the sons of Israel. John MacArthur, in his commentary on verses 16 through 21 here, say, this is the saddest text in the Old Testament. Now, I don't know if I entirely agree with him, but it certainly is on the top big list of sad things in the Old Testament. God is fulfilling his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's made it a great nation in terms of numerically. It's going to continue to grow. He's going to take them in there. He's going he's going to defeat the people that live there now, dispossess them himself, God will say. And he's already saying, but this is what's going to happen when they fall away. Questions, comments? About that passage. Really fun passage, isn't it? Well, let's go on. Let's read 23 through 30, which will take us to the end of the chapter. Then he commissioned Joshua, the son of Nun, and said, be strong and courageous, for you shall bring the sons of Israel into the land which I swore to them, and I will be with you. It came about when Moses finished writing the words of the law in a book until they were complete, that Moses commanded the Levites who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, saying, take this book of the law and place it beside the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may remain there as a witness against you. For I know your rebellion and your stubbornness. Behold, while I am still alive with you today, you have been rebellious against the Lord. How much more then after my death? Assemble to me all the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I may speak these words in their hearing, and call the heavens and the earth to witness against them. For I know that after my death you will act corruptly and turn from the way which I have commanded you. and evil will befall you in the latter days. For you will do that which is evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger with the work of your hands. Then Moses spoke in the hearing of all the assembly of Israel the words of this song until they were complete. And chapter 32 is the song. So now we have God still talking in verse 23, and he commissioned Joshua, the son of Nun, and he said to him, be strong, be courageous. You're going to bring Israel into the land I promised them, and I will be with you. Very strong affirmation of what Joshua is to do in his place in God's hierarchy and doing it, and God's commitment to him to go with him in the process. Then Moses continued to write the law down. When he got it finished, he asked the Levites to carry it with the Ark of the Covenant, which had been stated before that that's what would happen. And he said, take this book of the law, the covenant of Yahweh Elohim, and put it beside the ark. It will remain as a witness. What does he say? A witness in what way? Against you. How would you like to carry a book around with one of your most important pieces of worship of God, the Ark of the Covenant, and know that the whole time you're taking it with you, its purpose is to be a witness against you? There's some information there for those people that should have taken that very seriously, to guard against it, to plead with God, Lord, keep me from doing that. But Moses goes on to say, why do you need this? Well, I know your rebellion, your stubbornness. Has Moses seen much rebellion and stubbornness? Moses can say, I know you well. And look, he says, even as I yet live today, you've rebelled against Yahweh. What are you going to do when I'm not here? And the people have some kind of an idea of what Moses' role was with God, because there are times in their rebellion they plead with him to go plead with God for mercy, for forgiveness. Take the plague away. Go talk to God. They get it, at least to some extent. They knew the role Moses was playing. And so he realizes just who they are and what they will do. And without him in that role, he's fearful for them. Not to take anything away from Joshua. But he says, get everybody together so I can proclaim these words and call the heavens and the earth to witness against them. We had a similar set of verses earlier. I think it was last week or the week before, where it said that he did it in the world under the heavens. And when they see creation, and we go back and think about God and the whole idea of the Sabbath and all of those things and the resting that goes along with God's resting, it all points back to creation. And once again, the heavens and the earth, creation itself, will be a witness against you. And it's a call to worship and to obey the Creator. Verse 29, he says, I know after I die, you're going to corrupt yourselves. You're going to turn from the way I commanded, and evil will come on you in the later days. And literally, that could be translated the end of days. You're going to provoke his anger at the work of your hands. Why can Moses be so sure? Well, we've all just recently talked about his experience, but also God had told him, this is what's coming. And so with that, let's turn over to chapter 32. Questions? I'll take any questions or comments first, though. Let's read. I'm going to read the whole thing. It's fairly long. 43 verses is the song itself, and then there's more to the chapter. I'm going to read the whole thing and just take it in and hear it. This is what they were to memorize. What God said, they're going to remember it. And I'm going to say there probably was never an easier exercise to be sure that the people that learned it would keep it learned and teach it to the next generation than if God said they would. And so they were to learn this. And here's what Moses gave them to learn. Give ear, O heavens, and let me speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. Let my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, as the droplets on the fresh grass, as the showers on the herb. For I proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God, the rock. His word is perfect, for all his ways are just. A God of faithfulness and without injustice, righteous and upright is he. They have acted corruptly toward him. They are not his children because of their defect, but are a perverse and crooked generation. Do you thus repay the Lord, O foolish and unwise people? Is not he your father who has bought you? He has made you and established you. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of all generations. Ask your father and he will inform you, your elders and they will tell you, when the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of man, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the sons of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the allotment of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land and in the howling waste of a wilderness. He encircled him. He cared for him. He guarded him as the pupil of his eye. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that hovers over its young, he spread his wings and caught them. He carried them on his pinions. The Lord alone guided him, and there was no foreign God with him. He made him ride on the high places of the earth, and he ate the produce of the field, and he made him suck honey from the rock and oil from the flinty rock, curds of cows and milk of the flock with fat of lambs and rams, the breed of Bashan and goats, with the finest of the wheat and the blood of grapes you drank wine. But Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. You are grown fat, thick, and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and scorned the rock of his salvation. They made him jealous with strange gods. With abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons who were not God, to gods whom they have not known, new gods who came lately, whom your fathers did not dread. You neglected the rock who begot you and forgot the God who gave you birth. The Lord saw this and spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and daughters. Then he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end shall be, for they are a perverse generation, sons in whom is no faithfulness. They have made me jealous with what is not God. They have provoked me to anger with their idols. So I will make them jealous with those who are not a people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. A fire is kindled in my anger and burns to the lowest part of Sheol and consumes the earth with its yield and sets on fire the foundations of the mountains. I will heap misfortunes on them. I will use my arrows on them. They will be wasted by famine and consumed by plague and bitter destruction, and the teeth of beasts I will send upon them with the venom of crawling things of the dust. Outside the sword will be reeve, and inside terror, both young man and virgin, the nursling with the man of gray hair. I would have said, I will cut them to pieces. I will remove the memory of them from men, had I not feared the provocation by the enemy that their adversaries would misjudge, that they would say, our hand is triumphant, and the Lord has not done all this. For they are a nation lacking in counsel, and there is no understanding in them. Would that they were wise, that they understood this, that they would discern their future. How could one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight unless their rock had sold them, and the Lord had given them up? Indeed, their rock is not like our rock. Even our enemies themselves judge this. For their vine is from the vine of Sodom and from the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of poison, their clusters bitter. Their wine is the venom of serpents and the deadly poison of cobras. Is it not laid up in store with me, sealed with my treasuries? Vengeance is mine and retribution. In due time, their foot will slip. For the day of their calamity is near, and the impending things are hastening upon them. For the Lord will vindicate his people, and he will have compassion on his servants when he sees their strength is gone, and there is none remaining, bond or free. And he will say, where are their gods, the rock in which they sought refuge? Who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offering? Let them rise up and help you. Let them be your hiding place. See now that I am he, and there is no God besides me. It is I who put to death and give life. I have wounded, and it is I who heal. And there is no one who can deliver from my hand. Indeed, I lift up my hand to heaven, and I say as I live forever, if I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on justice, I will render vengeance on my adversaries, and I will repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword will devour flesh. With the blood of the slain and the captives from the long-haired leaders of the enemy, rejoice, O nations, with his people. For he will avenge the blood of his servants and will render vengeance on his adversaries and will atone for his land and his people. Okay, I think you could all have that memorized by next week. It gives us a little bit of an idea of what Moses was laying before them, because God had told him to lay it before them, have them memorize this song. It's called a song. Was it set to music? I don't know. Maybe it stayed as prose. I'm guessing it went to music because music makes things easier to memorize. And so can you imagine memorizing this as a foundational piece of becoming a nation? Yeah, enjoy our prosperity because we're going to mess it up. Let's take a look at this with a little bit more detail than me just reading it. This is a message, and it's addressed in the first verse. It says, give ear, who? O heavens, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. Before this song is done, it will even be obvious. This is about Israelites, but it's a message to all the nations if they will but hear it. And certainly, as we've seen earlier, he's in the earth. The earth is there as a testimony about who God is as well, the earth and the heavens. And so all that's brought together in that first verse. And he says, let my teachings drop as the rain, my speech like the dew, droplets on the fresh grass and showers on the herb. In verse 3 says, I'm proclaiming the name of the Lord. Ascribe greatness to our God. And he introduces this word for God called the rock. His work is perfect. His ways are just. He's faithful and without injustice, righteous, upright. So in those first four verses, he lifts God up. And even says, when he's talking about his own teaching, when you think about the rains and the dew, don't we think about that brings sustenance to the earth and the processes of growing and providing for the people on it? And so he says he wants these words to be nurturing to the people, like rain, like dew would be. But even though he spends the first four verses holding God up, when we get to verse 5, they've acted corruptly. Even to the point that said they're not his children, but are a perverse and crooked generation. Because God's children would have to be upright, would they not? Could they claim to be God's children apart from being God-like? Ask a question. Verse 6, do you repay the Lord, O foolish and unwise people? Is that how you give him back thanks for what he's done? He's your father. He bought you. How did he buy them? What's that?
He made them.
That's the next line.
He redeemed them from the land of Egypt.
That's right. Who were they in Egypt? They were slaves. They were powerless. They cried out to God, and God heard their cry, it said. And he came, and as a part of freeing them from Egypt, he is also keeping them from the damage of the plagues. Some of the plagues may have affected everybody in the early part, but the Jews knew they were coming and knew what to do. But by the time we get through the plagues a little bit, God starts making the plague only happen on the Egyptians, right? But the last plague was different. Did it only happen to the Egyptians in terms of the area, the peoples that were threatened by it? What do you think? Were God's people threatened by that last? What was the last plague?
It was Passover.
The Passover. Did God just say, oh, look and see if they're Jews? And if they are, this plague doesn't apply to them? No. It took the blood of the lamb on the doorpost, right? And after God took them out, he said, by the way, I spared your firstborn. They are now mine. By the time we get here, he has traded the firstborn for the Levites. We're not going to go through all the details of how that happened, but God bought them. They belong to him. They are his. And they're repaying him by rebellion. Their corrupt behavior sets them aside as children. It's a rhetoric question. Is this how you repay Yahweh with foolish and unwise actions? He's your father. He bought you. He made you. He established you. We talked about that. Moving on. Verses 7-14 are a call to remember the past. All the generations have gone before. He starts with Jacob and how he separated Jacob from the rest of the world. He set boundaries for Jacob's inheritance, the land, the people. He made Jacob's descendants his people. He found Jacob in the desert, but he enveloped him. He cared for him. He guided him. He provided for him. Foreign gods were kept out, and he provided for him the best in the land. Verse 15 has an interesting word there. Jeshurun became fattened. Well, what that word really means is the upright one. It could have been translated that way. That's what that word means. The upright one, symbolic of Israel and its ideal character, had they carried forward with it, they got fat. They rejected God. They scorned the rock of salvation. And they worshiped demons and gave sacrifices to them. So in 19 through 25, we see Yahweh spurns them. He hides his face. He became jealous. He provoked them to anger with a foolish nation. What does that mean? What's he talking about there? How would God provoke them to anger with a foolish nation? Or nations? The nations that came and took the people of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom captive, were they Yahweh worshipers?
No.
They were godless. They were foolish. But God provoked them by letting those foolish nations overcome them out of his fiery anger. He heaped misfortunes on them. They had plagues. They had destructions. They were unsafe in the presence of beasts. And he said, the sword comes against the young and the old. It wasn't just the adult men, but the great destruction came and it affected all. But God limits the destruction by the foreign nations, verses 26 through 28. And there's a reason that he does that. So that these foreign or foolish nations would not misunderstand. He wants those nations to realize that it was his power that let them do that. That clearly God must have put the Israelites in that position to be defeated for his own purposes. So he didn't want them to think they did it. He said the cities and the nations are without counsel and don't understand. And so he's going to limit the success he gives them so they won't become enamored with the idea that it was their power. In verses 30 through 35, God shows it was his power and judgment that brought the destruction. Otherwise, how could one person scatter 1,000? When he says one scatters 1,000 here and two scatters 10,000, he's talking about these foreign nations coming in. They were that effective. And they were only that effective because God was involved. In verse 31, he says, their rock is not like our rock. And he says, the enemy knows this. They know their gods are not as powerful as Yahweh. And so this becomes a metaphor of the evil they bring. And he brings in some more metaphors. Their vine is like the vine of Sodom. Their poison are like grapes from Gomorrah. They're like poisonous snakes. But God says, the vengeance is mine. These foreign nations are going to slip. They're going to err. And they're going to know calamity themselves. So God doesn't raise up these foreign nations for prosperity for a long time. It's for this time that they will be showing God's people the results of abandoning God himself. And then in verse 36, it says, Yahweh will vindicate his people. The remnant will be shown compassion. He says, when their strength is gone and no one is left, bond or free. I think it's talking about the rebellious ones there. When the rebellious ones are done with their rebellion, or they're not alive anymore, they're done. When we reach that point, then he can go back to blessing the people of Israel. And he says, at that time, where are their gods? Where are these rocks that they trusted in, who consumed their sacrifices? Let them save you. But in verse 39 through 43, says, now see and know that I am he. There's no God beside me. I put to death and I give life. I wound and I heal. No one can deliver from my hand. If I lift my hand to heaven, I live forever. I can take my sword and out of justice deliver vengeance. Through arrows and swords, I can shed blood and devour the flesh of the leaders of the enemy. He says, so rejoice, O nations, with his people. All nations should rejoice that God puts down those evil nations that raise up. I think we've even seen that in our not-so-distant history. He does avenge the blood of his servants and will atone for his land and his people. That's how he winds this up. He is going to avenge the blood of his servants, the people that were caught up in this, and atone for the land and his people. He atones for the land by the sacrifice of his enemies. He takes his vengeance on them, and he atones for the people by the blood of Jesus Christ. He's got to be looking forward here when he talks about atoning for his people. That's where atonement really comes from, is the blood of Christ on the cross to pay the debts for their sin. Questions, comments? I think he's talking about both. I mean, I think many, many prophetic type passages have a near, usually lesser fulfillment, and they have a further, greater, complete fulfillment. And I think both of those are in that. That's my opinion. Those kinds of things are interesting to think about. So many times, and in this case, we could look at the Old Testament. I don't have the verses lined out, wouldn't be prepared to do that. But we can see the restoration of Israel. We can look at Ezra and Nehemiah, see the rebuilding of the temple. We can see those kinds of things happen. We can see that by the time Jesus comes back, while they're not sovereign in the way we would normally think of a nation, they're under Roman rule. The nation's there and they're back together. They've got a lot of differences between the northern and the southern nations. They're not united as a people, but God has brought them back through primarily the graces of the kings that took them captive. I say graces, I don't know if that's the right word, but they're allowing them to come back. When God talks about bringing his people from across the nations throughout the world and bringing them back and atoning for them, I'm pretty sure that's, they'll look on him whom they've pierced. But that's just my opinion. So history gets involved and helps shape our understanding as we look at the latter days. And for sure, one thing that's interesting right now, and I'm not hearing this from religious sources at all, and I'm not trying to say that it is a fulfillment of prophecy for sure, but it's got my interest a little bit. The largest collection of Jewish people that are living outside of Israel right now is in New York City. And many of those are preparing an exodus to Israel, believing that this recent election where they elected an anti-Semite, that their safety is no longer adequate in New York. Now, I said many. I don't know if it's most or how big it is. That's just one of the things that's kind of hitting the news now is in the migration from New York that people are saying is preparing to happen. That's one group that's preparing to do that. And it's interesting that they didn't pick some other place to report in the news that the Jews are moving with the rest of the people to Florida or whatever. No, it's Israel they took an interest in that made the news. What's really going to happen, I don't know. But I found that at least interesting.
Yeah.
Any other questions, comments, thoughts? Well, let's take a look at the rest of this chapter. 44 through 52. Then Moses came and spoke all the words of this song in the hearing of the people, he with Joshua the son of Nun. When Moses had finished speaking all these words to all Israel, he said to them, "Take to your heart all the words with which I am warning you today, which you shall command your sons to observe carefully, even all the words of this law. For it is not an idle word for you. Indeed, it is your life. And by this word, you will prolong your days in the land which you are about to cross the Jordan to possess." The Lord spoke to Moses that very same day, saying, "Go up this mountain of Abiram, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, opposite Jericho, and look at the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the sons of Israel for a possession. Then die on the mountain where you ascend, and be gathered to your people, and Aaron your brother died on Mount Hor, and was gathered to his people, because you broke faith with me in the midst of the sons of Israel at the waters of Meribah Kadesh, in the wilderness of Zin, because you did not treat me as holy in the midst of the sons of Israel. For you shall see the land at a distance, but you shall not go there into the land which I am giving to the sons of Israel." And so Moses spoke all these words, and he did it in the presence of Joshua the son of Nun. And when he finished speaking, he said to them, "Take heart, take to your heart all the words with which I'm warning you today. Don't just memorize them. Make them a part of who you are. That which I command you and your sons to observe carefully, even the words of your law." Why? These are not idle words. They're not just interesting words. They're not tending to entertain. It is your life. "And by this word you will prolong your days in the land which you are about to cross the Jordan to possess." And so, much like we look at the scriptures, Moses is saying, look at these words, scriptures to them certainly, and realize it's your life. For us, we look at the scriptures and say, it's eternity. Peter got it right. Where else are we going to go, Lord? You have the words of eternal life. We should be at least as intense as they would have been if they had followed this well. And then the Lord told Moses the same day, "Go up on the mountain of Abiram," and Abiram is the mountainous chain. The specific peak is Nebo. "There in the land of Moab, opposite Jericho, just across the Jordan from Jericho, and look at Canaan, what I'm giving Israel for a possession, and die on the mountain. Be gathered to your people like Aaron died on Hor and was gathered to his people." And once again, it's voiced. Why? "Because you broke faith with me in the midst of the sons of Israel in the waters of Meribah Kadesh. Because you did not treat me as holy in the midst of the sons of Israel. You will see the land, But you shall not go there into the land which I am giving the sons of Israel. Kind of a somber note there, isn't it? And yet, every time I read about that, I think of the Transfiguration. And despite Moses' failure in this arena, the punishment from God, you don't get to go along into the promised land. He was there at the Transfiguration with Jesus in the later days. Questions, comments? All right, well, I'll remind you again, if you come in here next week, it probably will be dark, but even if it's well lit, you'll be by yourself after a while. We're going to be meeting in the big room, and the following week, I think it will be a treat for you to hear again about Jericho. All right, thank you. See you soon.